Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, we're 4 weeks away until Election Day, when voters will decide whether to recall Governor Gavin Newsom, and if so, who they want to replace him. We have an exciting programming note to pass along to our audience. I, along with two of my fellow journalists from the Sacramento Bee, will be moderating the Sacramento Press Club's debate between four of the Republican gubernatorial candidates. The debate will be held at the Guild Theater in Oak Park. CAP Radio will be airing the debate in its entirety tomorrow at 9 a.m. during our normal Insight slot, followed by a half-hour special with analysis and commentary following the debate. So just please join us for this special event, 9 a.m. tomorrow, right here on CAP Radio. In the meantime, ballots for the California recall election are set to arrive in mailboxes across the state this week. I just got my text alert this morning. And as they do, voters will be confronted with not just the decision on whether to recall and replace Governor Newsom, but also with misinformation about how the process works. CAP Radio's PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols is here this morning to fact-check some rumors about the recall and demystify some confusing issues. He joins us now. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, Vicky. Good morning. It's great to be here.
Well, Chris, before we get to the false rumors, just explain some of the basics that voters need to know about the recall. What are the two questions they'll be asked on their ballot?
Well, the first question we'll ask, shall Gavin Newsom be recalled, meaning removed, from the office of governor? And voters can choose either yes or no on this question. A yes vote means you want Newsom to be recalled, and a no vote means you would like Newsom to remain as governor. If more than 50% vote to recall Newsom, the replacement candidate who wins the most votes becomes governor.
Well, that gets us to the second part. I mean, there's dozens of candidates, a list of 46 potential replacements. Do voters have to choose a replacement if they don't want to recall the governor?
No, they do not. Voters do not have to select a replacement candidate. If they vote no on recalling Newsom, that vote will still count whether they select a replacement or not. But you can also vote no on recalling Newsom and then go ahead and make a selection for a replacement. Both of your votes will count under that scenario. There has been confusion about how this works, but in general, voters have a lot of freedom in how they answer or decline to answer those two questions on the ballot. My colleague Nicole Nixon published a voter guide this week at capradio.org. It provides a lot more information about how the process works and key dates for the election, and it answers a lot of common questions.
Yeah, of course, I follow Nicole on Twitter, and I liked her tweet yesterday when she was talking about if you don't want to recall the governor on the second question, you can't put Governor Gavin Newsom, you can't write him in into the ballot. That will not count.
That's right. I didn't even realize that. I'm learning a lot just reading her work. I definitely recommend people check it out at capradio.org.
Well, you're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio PolitiFact reporter Chris Nichols about what you need to know about the upcoming recall election and misinformation surrounding the recall process. Chris, there are many false claims out there about the recall election. I mean, what are the big ones that you're looking into?
You're right. And unfortunately, there is a lot of misinformation out there, especially on social media. Election officials here in Sacramento County, they recently sent out a notice about one very false rumor that's going around. It claims that voters won't be able to cast their ballot in person due to the county's new health order. And that's the one we've reported on this. It requires people to, again, wear masks at indoor public settings, regardless of their vaccination status. And that's due to the fast-spreading Delta variant. We know that several other counties, such as Los Angeles and Yolo County, have this same mandate. But in Sacramento County, the election spokesperson, Jana Haynes, told me there is no truth to this rumor about not being able to vote in person due to the mask mandate.
That is false. As you may remember, in November, we were in a much different situation with COVID, and we still held a full election with vote centers in person. None of that has changed. The only thing that's different in this election is the time frame that we had to turn it around in.
Haynes went on to say that the short turnaround time means There will be fewer in-person voting sites. Back in November for the general election, there were 84. For the recall, there'll be about 30. But again, the mask mandate will not stop in-person voting. And as a reminder, no matter where you live in California, your county elections office also serves as an in-person voting site during normal business hours.
Well, that last rumor brings to mind the question about masking at polling sites. Will voters be required to wear masks when they cast their ballot?
This is something I think probably a lot of people have on their minds. Haynes says that Sacramento County will make masks available to everyone who shows up to an in-person voting site, just like last fall. She also says that no one will be turned away and denied their right to vote because they aren't wearing a mask, but they might be asked to wait for a few moments for election staff to set up a more isolated place for them to vote away from others.
Well, that's good to know. There's one more recall rumor that Sacramento County election staff, I mean, they shot down last week. Can you just remind us what that was about?
They've been pretty aggressive in shooting down these rumors. And this false claim said that the county elections office had hired two employees from the Dominion Voting Systems company. And Dominion makes voting machines. And after last fall's presidential election, right-wing media and supporters of former President Donald Trump, they spread false claims that Dominion had rigged ballots in favor of President Joe Biden through their voting machines. And election officials and fact checkers like PolitiFact found no credible evidence showing the company's system affected any vote tallies.
So is there any connection between the company and Sacramento County?
Well, Sacramento County uses some Dominion voting machines, and it contracts with the company for support to make sure the machines run properly. Dominion recently helped the county with an accuracy test to ensure the machines count recall ballots correctly, but Haynes told me the county elections office has its own internal information technology team. That team makes the actual adjustments. The Dominion contractors do not do that. They provide guidance and are not employees. Here's Haynes.
We felt the need to set the record straight. We do not have any Dominion employees that are employed by Sacramento County. We never have. We never will. Obviously, we do use Dominion machines, and so it would be a huge conflict of interest to have them employed here.
Haynes says that false rumor appears to have started at a cyber symposium organized to push the discredited theories that last fall's election was stolen.
There is just so much out there and so much to sift through. Thanks, Chris, for helping us sort through some of it.
Thank you very much, Vicki. Great to be here.
And that's Cap Radio's PolitiFact California reporter, Chris Nichols. Now, you can find more fact checks at capradio.org, including our guide to misinformation about the California recall. Now, for those who still need to register to vote, the deadline is August 30th, or you can register day of on September 14th at your designated polling place. And as a reminder, I, along with two fellow journalists from the Sacramento Bee, will be moderating the Sacramento Press Club's debate between four of the Republican gubernatorial candidates. That debate will be held at the Guild Theater in Oak Park. Cap Radio will be airing the debate in its entirety Wednesday at 9 a.m. in Place of Insight, followed by a half-hour special with analysis and commentary following the debate. So just join us for this special event, 9 a.m. Wednesday, right here on Cap Radio. Up next, Sacramento is home to the largest Afghan refugee community in the country. We check in as they watch the Taliban take over Afghanistan. You can also join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The world is watching what is unfolding in Afghanistan as the Taliban swiftly takes over, just as the U.S. began to pull troops out of the country. The images of desperation are just heart-wrenching and chaotic, as many try to get out of the country, clinging to planes and running alongside the tarmac. This leaves many to ask, was the past 20 years, spanning four U.S. presidents, worth the sacrifice? Yesterday afternoon, President Biden addressed the country and stands by his decision.
I stand squarely behind my decision. After 20 years, I've learned the hard way that there was never a good time to withdraw U.S. forces. That's why we're still there. We were clear-eyed about the risks. We planned for every contingency, but I always promised the American people that I would be straight with you. The truth is, this did unfold more quickly than we had anticipated.
President Biden also mentioned that this pullback stemmed from a deal President Donald Trump had made.
When I came into office, I inherited a deal that President Trump negotiated with the Taliban. Under his agreement, U.S. forces would be out of Afghanistan by May 1, 2021, just a little over 3 months after I took office. U.S. forces had already drawn down during the Trump administration from roughly 15,500 American forces to 2,500 troops in country.
Sacramento actually has the largest Afghan refugee community in the country. And the events happening on the other side of the world undoubtedly have affected many that are worrying about loved ones in their home country. Joining us now to help us understand a little more about what's going on in Afghanistan and how it affects Afghan refugees is Jesse Chenchu with Opening Doors. That is one of five refugee resettlement agencies in Sacramento. Jesse, welcome to Insight.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You know, how many Afghan refugees are in Sacramento?
You know, it's hard to estimate accurate numbers, but Sacramento is home to the largest population of Afghan refugees and Afghan Americans in the country. So there's a community of thousands here.
Yeah, Opening Doors has such a unique relationship with this community. What are you hearing in the past days?
It's a frightening time for people. These are, it's not simply a humanitarian crisis unfurling on the other side of the world. These are people's siblings and parents and loved ones, and people are very worried.
Yeah. And I also can hear that in your voice as well. How many more are you expecting in the coming weeks?
So things are a little uncertain now with the status of the airport in Kabul and the ability of flights to leave the country. Things are rapidly changing. Last I had heard, the flights were still suspended for the moment. We are hopeful that the troops will be able to secure the airport and flights will be able to resume. We could potentially see as many as 1,700 Afghan refugees coming to the Sacramento area before, in the next couple of months, assuming that the evacuation flights are able to continue.
Are you surprised at how quickly things unfolded over the weekend?
Yes, I think like many, we expected something like this to happen, but not on this time frame.
President Biden talked about the continued help to refugees who want to leave the country. Let's take a listen.
Operation Allies Refugee, which I announced back in July, has already moved 2,000 Afghans who are eligible for special immigration visas and their families to the United States. In the coming days, the U.S. military will provide assistance to move more SIV-eligible Afghans and their families out of Afghanistan. We're also expanding refugee access to cover other vulnerable Afghans who work for our embassy. U.S. non-governmental agencies or U.S. non-governmental organizations and Afghans who otherwise are at great risk in U.S. news agencies. I know there are concerns about why we did not begin evacuating Afghans, civilians sooner. Part of the answer is some of the Afghans did not want to leave earlier, still hopeful for their country. And part of it because the Afghan government and its supporters discouraged us from organizing a mass exodus to avoid triggering, as they said, a crisis of confidence.
Jesse, what stands out to you about the president's remarks?
Well, we had a presence for 20 years in Afghanistan. And so the number of Afghans who are at risk now due to their affiliation with the U.S., it's huge. There are 18,000 Afghans that have applied for the special immigrant visa. And it's, we have to keep in mind, it's not just the interpreter who's at risk. It's his wife, it's his children, it's the entire family. So that 18,000 individuals who've applied for the special immigrant visa represent something closer to 80,000 people. So I'm hopeful of the 2,000 that have been able to leave the country, but that's just a drop in the bucket. And the sense of urgency really has to be on getting our allies to safety and following through on the commitments that we made.
Can you just explain what the Operation Allies Refugee is? Because the president did mention it, and I don't know if a lot of people are aware of it.
So there's a push to get SIV applicants as well as P2 refugees out of the country. So in order to qualify for the special immigrant visa program, there's a series of steps that applicants have to go through, including things like have a demonstrated work history with the U.S. government for 2 years, a letter of recommendation from their supervisor, things like that. Now, there's also on August 2nd, the State Department announced the P2 designation program for refugees, which is for a slightly broader category of individuals, might be individuals who worked for the U.S. government but do not qualify for special immigrant visa. It could be humanitarian workers. It could be women's rights advocates, journalists, others who may be at risk because of their affiliations.
For those who want to resettle in the United States, just how long is the process? I mean, it's an important reminder.
The typical screening process is 2 years. The refugees are the most thoroughly vetted category of traveler to the United States. So the typical screening process takes 2 years.
Does the closure of the embassy in Afghanistan complicate things?
I'm not entirely certain of what the current status is for visa processing there. If we are unable to process visas in Kabul, it will be very challenging because borders into other countries are closed. And so people will have a difficult time getting to a second country to apply for a refugee visa in another embassy.
We were talking about complications just at the airport and trying to get out of the country. How does the Taliban takeover further affect how people who are seeking refuge in the U.S.?
In Afghanistan?
Yes. They want to resettle here.
Yeah. So it's challenging for those in Afghanistan, but outside of Kabul. We've seen that there are difficulties getting onto flights at the airport, but there are also difficulties just getting to Kabul. There are many people who may qualify for the special immigrant visa program or may qualify for the P2 refugee visa who are not in Kabul. And it's a they're at great risk just getting from where they're currently to Kabul in hopes that they will be able to evacuate the country through the Kabul airport.
What are the next steps for opening doors? I mean, at the beginning of our conversation, you talked about 1,700 individuals that may resettle.
Mm-hmm. So we are committed to welcoming our new neighbors here in Sacramento. We are continuing to watch things unfold in Kabul very closely, and we are hopeful that evacuation flights will be able to resume. New arrivals to Sacramento are coming at a time where we are facing a great housing crisis. And so it's important to our team that we are able to ensure that refugees are not just fleeing safety, but they're also being set up for new lives of stability and security here in Sacramento. So we're working very hard to secure housing and connect newcomers to services to ensure their stability here.
What can the community do to help?
Yeah, there are two suggestions that I could make locally. You can sign up to volunteer at openingdoorsinc.org. Once you go through the volunteer application process, you can sign up to welcome your newest neighbors. That might be going to the airport, that might be helping to set up an apartment, that might be meeting an Afghan mother and her kids for a play date at the park and practicing English. There are lots of ways to support your newest neighbors that way. The other thing I could suggest would be to call your representatives to urge the administration to expand and expedite access to the U.S. resettlement program for Afghan refugees.
Jesse, thanks for all you do and taking the time to just kind of explain what's happening here in Sacramento.
Sure. Thank you so much, Vicki.
Jesse Chenchu is with Opening Doors. That is one of five refugee resettlement agencies in Sacramento. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan. We're joined now by a refugee to get an even deeper understanding of what's going on and how it affects the community in Sacramento. Haidar Ali Maradi worked as a translator for the United States in Afghanistan. He now works at Encina Preparatory High School in Sacramento. Haidar, welcome to Insight.
Thanks, Vicki. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for taking the time. I mean, let's just start off with a little bit of a backstory. How long ago did you move to the United States and what brought you here?
We moved to the United States in 2014. As a result of my service to the United States aid missions. So I did come through this, what they call a special immigrant visa program. And back then it was not as complicated, but yes, that was the visa that I got and we moved to the Sacramento.
Why was it important for you to become a translator and help the United States?
It goes back to my background. You know, I had a financial background, and so there were two things. I had to, courage to help my people who didn't have access to finance. And the USAID mission, they had a project of, you know, promoting finance and to teach people how to use loans and. That's the result of, you know, me being targeted by the Taliban insurgents back then because they thought I was promoting interest-based financing, which is prohibited by, you know, the Islamic laws. Yeah.
I was watching a piece that CAP Radio's Andrew Nixon did on you back in 2017 at Encina High. I mean, you speak multiple languages and you're really able to help bridge the language gap at that high school. And you're often the first person families see. I mean, you do a lot of coordinating. You're a very busy person at school. What does this job mean to you?
Well, here's the thing. I still work for the same school district, but not that specific high school. It was a privilege for me to work in a place to be able to use all my language skills. And that specific high school has a lot of new refugee kids from different countries, different backgrounds. And all the languages that I am able to speak, we had families coming to that high school speaking that languages. I was really proud of my abilities to help those navigate through their curriculums, students' curriculums, to know how the school system works, basically, after they were done with the district. So they came to this high school and they were comfortable talking to me. They used to share their stories and their problems, their children's academic challenges. And that was a good start for me too.
Yeah, some people might be surprised to learn how large and significant the Afghan refugee community is here in Sacramento. How would you describe it?
It is a large community, and it's getting just larger. It's just getting larger, except for the fact that we are still facing, Jesse said, that we are still facing housing challenges. And, the cost of living in California is a big problem. And most of the refugees that come to Sacramento, they have either a friend or a family that they can depend on, that they can receive a support aside, apart from the, resettlement agencies. It's good to have a family and friends in a city that you are going to be resettled. So that's one of the other reasons that most Afghan refugees are, flowing into Sacramento because they have either families or friends here.
The world is watching what's going on in Afghanistan with shock. I mean, how are you doing?
It's a difficult times for all the, Afghans living around the world. Even if we are outside Afghanistan, we have families and friends. Our thoughts and hearts are still, in Afghanistan. We have families, we have siblings, we have parents who live in that under now the Taliban ruled Afghanistan. And it is chaotic. We are, my wife was the other day, she was crying, what's going to happen? Everyone is locked in their homes, waiting for what's going to happen without knowing their, even near future. They just wait and watch.
Have you been able to talk to loved ones who are still in Afghanistan?
Yes, only to the ones who are in Kabul, but not to the ones who are in the provinces, because either they don't have electricity or they don't have the, the internet facility, the cell phone towers are inactive because their people are not there anymore. They flee to the main cities, they flee to Kabul, or they flee outside Afghanistan if they could. As much as we could, we did contact people, we did talk to people, but, we have to be careful who we are calling and what time, because we don't know who they are when at that time.
Oh, I can only imagine just how concerned you are and not being able to have that regular communication and check up on people that you love.
It is a difficult time.
Are you surprised at how seemingly quick the country was taken over?
I am surprised by the fact that the United States made a decision. They have every right to make that decision, but it could have been in a better way. It could have been in a more secure way, that even the Taliban themselves were not expecting. They were shocked. How did this happen?
Well, in his remarks yesterday, President Biden said that no amount of military intervention from the United States could help with the ongoing conflicts. Let's take a quick listen to an excerpt of what he said.
The events we're seeing now are sadly proof that no amount of military force would ever deliver a stable, united, secure Afghanistan, as known in history as the graveyard of empires. What's happening now could just as easily happen 5 years ago or 15 years in the future. We have to be honest. Our mission in Afghanistan has taken made many missteps over the past two decades.
I mean, Haidar, given how closely you worked with the United States and helped our country as a translator, what are your thoughts on the president's remarks yesterday?
He's absolutely right. There's, in the history, if you look back in the history, there's not a single country that's being built by another country. It's even if it is Russia, it is that, you know, the world's most superpower. But in case of Afghanistan, as long as the terrorist groups like Taliban, like Al-Qaeda, they have safe havens in Pakistan and they have, you know, the very safe breeding grounds in Pakistan, no military can cope with them. Because you get rid of 100 of them and there's basically no border. Another 1,000 will come from Pakistan.
As someone who works in a school, you're clearly passionate about children and teenagers. Are you concerned about the children who will live in a very different Afghanistan under Taliban rule, especially girls and women?
I'm really concerned about the future of the children. I'm born in war and I'm being raised in war and I'm a wartime child. You know, now I have gray hair in my hair and all I remember from Afghanistan is war and dying and killing, you know. So I still remember, but I'm deeply concerned about the future of Afghanistan, especially girls, because Taliban has taken over all over the country and this is their time to, even if they promise that they will forgive, you know, and they will give women their rights, I wouldn't believe them because looking at their past, it's not only 5 years that they have ruled the country, but the past 25 years that all the things happened to the woman by their groups. So I don't believe them. I'm really concerned.
Yeah, and I think especially given that you came here to the United States after fearing for the safety of you and your family for working with the United States, there are so many others in your situation that are still essentially locked into Afghanistan and can't get out of the country. How concerned are you about their future and their safety in the weeks and months ahead?
I'm deeply concerned, Vicky, for the future of all those people who helped the United States Army or, you know, aid missions in Afghanistan. Because when I was working with the aid missions and we had, common projects that we used to work with the U.S. Army and, you know, the threats that we have received, they thought they were calling us traitors who are being used against our own countries. And they used to tell us, you know, through the phone, through the messages, that we are the ones who help the U.S. soldiers navigate through the villages, navigate through the cities. So even if they say that they won't retaliate, I don't believe them. Because, you know, what their soldiers and what their, you know, fighters do in a village, they don't have to report to anyone. They don't bear any responsibility. Who is going to ask them what they have done to the people? The other day, I read on the one of the Facebook posts from the No One Left Behind, which is an NGO helping the SIV applicants. They have recently killed two translators who work with the U.S. Army.
And as Jesse pointed out, it's not just the translator; it's also their family as well. Yes. That's at risk.
My immediate family is here with me, but I'm deeply concerned about the extended family because they have our label with them. You know, we were the one who worked with the you know, foreigners, and our families are still there. But I'm more concerned for the future of all those people who are, you know, pending approval there about their for their visas, who are, you know, in the lengthy process of this SIV and the P2 program. I'm really concerned about them.
What do you think could have been done on the front end to help those who are seeking to get out of the country?
I would suggest, you know, I really hope that whoever is eligible to apply for these visas, you know, like you earlier you said, we have to talk to the, you know, representative to, you know, kind of enforce this idea to, you know, cut off the process. Do the background checks and then issue them visas as soon as you can before they or their family members get killed.
Finally, what are you hoping will happen over the coming weeks, months, and even years ahead for the people still living in Afghanistan?
You know, now the Taliban has taken over the country and it is what it is. If it is, you know, even if they kill people, people will still have to live there. But people who work with the, you know, U.S. Army and U.S. aid missions, I hope at least they get their, you know, chance to to flee the country. Of course, they won't target all the civilians, but they will definitely have their targets. They will definitely. I won't believe a word that the Taliban or the other terrorist groups say. They were the ones who killed people, who beheaded Tabassum, who was only a 12-year-old teenager of Hazara tribe. They were not in the army. They were not. They were just schoolgirls.
Haidar, I'm concerned. Yeah, no, and that's so understandable. Haidar, thank you so much for spending time with us, and I'm so sorry about all the worry that you're going through, and I just wish you the very best.
Thank you, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
Haidar Ali Moradi is an Afghan refugee living in Sacramento. He worked as a translator for the United States in Afghanistan and arrived in Sacramento with his family on a special immigrant visa after his life was threatened. Still ahead, we're going to take a look back and remember legendary restaurateur Randy Perugeri and his lasting influence on Sacramento. You can join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org. or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Randy Perugeri was a pioneering restaurateur in Sacramento, whose vision for what Sacramento could be was at one point ahead of his time. He passed away Friday evening at the age of 74, about a month after he was diagnosed with cancer. In his 50 years pioneering Sacramento's dining scene, a lot has changed, and the generations after him credit Randy Perugeri for the culinary town we enjoy today. Perugeri opened his first restaurant in 1969, the Parapau Palace, and over the decades opened many more, including Central Cocina Mexicana, R15, Cafe Bernardo, and of course his namesake, Perugeri's. So to remember his legacy by those who knew and learned from him, we are joined by co-owner and executive chef at Origami Asian Grill, Scott Ostrander, and co-owner of DeVere's Irish Pub, Henry DeVere White. Welcome both to Insight.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I just want to ask both of you, and I'll start with Henry. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I think it's been interesting to talk to everybody, and there's been a lot of text messages and pictures going around and people just kind of reminiscing. I was fortunate enough to work for Randy at R15 before opening DeVere's Irish Pub. So a lot of people have been sharing. I think everyone's seen it on social media. The impact of Randy was huge.
Yeah, and I guess that's such a beautiful silver lining when someone passes away. Scott, what was your connection to Randy Perugeri?
I worked for him for close to 13 years, off and on. The better part of the early career I had as a line cook and up into becoming, you know, a chef, was spent at many Cafe Bernardo's and Perugeri's.
How did Randy Perugeri influence you, Scott? You're now the executive chef and co-owner at Origami Asian Grill in East Sacramento.
I would say he influenced me mainly in business practices, like just being diligent about numbers and going over things. And, you know, if there are some mistakes, how to find them. as one of his chefs running his restaurants, you know, we had weekly manager meetings where we went over numbers and stuff like that. And so I use all that today. And it's very, you know, simplistic in math and things like that. But just to be diligent about it, but also, you know, take risks and things like that. If it had to do with hospitality towards guests, like that should always be at the forefront of what you're doing and make sure the guest experience is the best. And I like that he always made that part of his company mantra going forward, like, you know, asking guests how their experience was, and they get like gift cards and things like that in response to that. So I always appreciated how he put the guest perspective first.
Henry, how did Père Gary shape your career?
That was interesting because I came in as a bartender and while I was designing De Beers, and I was able to see the systems and the inventory systems. And when I worked at R15, I worked with Jason Boggs, who's the chef at the time. Garrett Van Fleck was doing door. Alex Oregoni was the general manager, and Matt Nerge was a bartender. And those guys all went on to do Shady Lady and other things. But we all got to sit around and talk about the systems and learn hospitality. The biggest impact Randy had on me was when we went to go open our bar, advice that he gave, and kind of managing and maneuvering through lobbying for making Sacramento better. I got a really big pedigree in how he worked with city officials and how he kind of steered conversations and used the hospitality business to make Sacramento better. And that was a life lesson that I'll not forget.
Yeah, I think about the past year and kind of the culinary legends that we've lost in Sacramento, from Biba, Lena Fat, and now Randy Père Gary. And I think what you're talking about is that Père Gary wasn't just known as, or wasn't just a chef, but he really had a vision for collaborating and investing in Sacramento's culinary scene.
100%. You know, I think Scott would agree with me, you know, opening a restaurant is a big endeavor and it's a risky endeavor and it's stressful and it's all those things, but for whatever reason, we love that aspect of hospitality. But Randy reinvested in Sacramento over and over again. And if you look over that 50 years, how many thousands of people paid rent because of him? How many thousands of people met people and fell in love and got married because of the spaces he created? How many people, you know, got to sit on a line like Scott and learn tricks from different people and hone their craft? I mean, that legacy is huge. And then you take it with his stance on making Sacramento a better city. Sacramento is a great town, but he didn't accept it that way. He pushed it forward, and he did it in a very graceful way and a very dedicated way. And I think there's people doing that in Sacramento daily, and they don't get the thank you. They do it because they love Sacramento. They want it to grow. And, you know, my biggest takeaway is I wish I would have thanked him for what he's done and the mentorship to all those people. And I think Scott and I, you know, now get to do that for other people. And it's amazing the impact. Even a small interaction can go so far.
I'd agree with that. Yeah.
You know, and just learning about him as someone who didn't work in the culinary scene here, you know, Randy was known not as a competitor, but really just a mentor to those who learned from him, just to go off and to pursue their own endeavors and their own restaurants, just like the both of you. And his vision for what Sacramento could be really just necessitated collaboration. And I think that is just a testament to his character and who he was as a person, even for someone who didn't know him personally. Scott?
Yeah, I mean, he picked a pretty great partner in Kurt Spataro, to be honest with you, and who's been equally as influential as Randy was in my life, in my career. But Randy always had a very good, like, sparkle in his eye for good food and good techniques and how to bring that to Sacramento, you know, with his wood fire pizza oven at Père Gary's being one of the first in town in many, many years. I've worked that oven so many times. It's a charm, you know, and I wish there were more of those ovens around town, but there's not, you know, quite frankly, there's only probably like five or six maybe. But just how he looked at food and the quality of food, you know, he's also the biggest critic. You know, if there was something that didn't come out of the kitchen right, he'd let you know. But that's what you loved about him too, because he was very honest about that.
He really influenced the way that service and food was seen in Sacramento. And I just think about how, we're talking about this, it just goes well beyond restaurants. You know, he was a major influence on the revitalization of the city corridor, the restaurant scene on K and R streets. Right, Henry?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at all the people that have been trying to fight to get K Street up to where it is today and to where it could be, Downtown Partnership, for example, Visit Sacramento, Randy put his money there and put the risk there, and he went there and he created spaces that are still there today. Randy was always in the meetings, pushing for the convention center, pushing for the theater, pushing for arts, helping to affect city codes, working with the connections he made in his restaurant, you know, because people will come in and have a drink, right? And you can chat and, you know, you can put your influence there. And the way he did it was masterful. And I think the impact that he had on our city, there's so many things that people have no idea that his fingerprints are on. And it was a huge lesson that, you know, you got to show up and push things forward. And I think he really had a vision that if everybody pushed Sacramento forward, we would all benefit both, you know, and that's, there's a lot of people in our city today that do that. And we should probably reach out and thank them, because it's a tough job and it's not easy. But he did it gracefully. And, I mean, I would watch him in meetings, and he was really graceful in how he approached things and people, and how he added to the conversation and directed it. And, you know, the amount of places he did in his career, from someone who does it now, is just amazing. That's a lot of work, and he did it. And he brought spaces to Sacramento that challenged all of us and kind of said, hey, if you want to do this on the go forward, right, you got to step up and at least meet my standard, if not try to beat it. And I think that's where we'll see his impact for years to come. I mean, go to Scott's place. His food's amazing. You know, I mean, go see Patrick Mulvaney, go find Adam Peckle, wherever he is cooking as a vagabond chef, go into Shady Lady and have a cocktail. I mean, I think you can see it over and over again. It's a huge impact.
Scott, what memorable stories do you have?
Oh, God. I think some of my fondest memories are when I was at Esquire, running the kitchen there. He had, what was called Table One, and he would get together with like Rusty Reyes and, city leaders and state leaders, and things like that. You know, Gavin Newsom, stuff like that would come through when he was lieutenant governor and such. And just the way that he communicated with friends, they were all his friends. That's, you know, it wasn't like business. It was just friends like creating, you know what I mean? Like that, you could feel like that energy, that good things were happening. And that's probably, you know, to what Henry was saying about his impact on the city and how he viewed things and how he wanted to bring things together and influence policy or whatever it may be in construction or whatever, with theater and arts. That stuff all kind of happened like every day. Like it didn't, if he ran into somebody, there was some creativity happening. He was such a positive person. And I remember at Esquire, like I could do no wrong, honestly. Like I had a free rein when it came to food. He was like, go with it. You got a good idea. You're passionate about it. Go with it. Let's see where it leads. And if it leads to something else, hey, let's explore that too. And I always admired that about him, and creativity, because I've always felt the same way.
Yeah, I mean, you can just see that in the restaurants that have followed him since. I mean, even just the restaurants he started and how different they were just in the type of food that they serve, not to mention the two of you have two very different restaurants. And you also drew inspiration and mentorship from Randy Perugary. I think, Henry, that just kind of lends itself to what Scott's saying, in that he just encouraged people to stay true to themselves, think creatively, and kind of have an open mind of what's possible in Sacramento.
What? Absolutely. I think especially if you look at his ability to adapt. I mean, we've overused this word pivot. So Scott, sorry, but you know, in the restaurant, we don't want to hear about pivoting anymore. But if you think about it, he was the original pivot, and he did it over and over again. And when something fails or something doesn't work, and you've invested that much time and energy into it, it's very defeating. And yet he just from the outside seemed to like gracefully move through it. And I think that's a big lesson on what we can do on the go forward in this next year, as we in the hospitality business face a lot of challenges, is to remember that, you know, as many successes as he had a couple hiccups here and there, but he was able to move and be creative in how he dealt with it. And that at the end of the day, he made it through all of those pivots and changes. And I think that was a huge thing. And I think, you know, for me, one of my best memories was when we were finishing DeVere's Irish Pub and it still smelled of stain. It was like 9 o'clock at night. I'm like desperately trying to make my open date. And in comes Randy. I think he was probably coming from Spitarles at that point with a couple guys and just gracefully walked in and sat down and kind of took it all in. And he had a big smile. I said, "Hey, hi, Randy. How's it going? We're almost open." He goes, "Wow, way to go all in on the bar." And he smiled at me. And I was like, I don't think he didn't mean anything by it. But to me, that was the biggest stamp of approval. Like he was kind of taken aback. And he was like, "Oh, this is good job." You know, and that's like having your dad come in and pat you on the back, you know, and to have him do that. And he stayed and chatted with me for a while. And I'll never forget that smile on his face and just what it felt like to have somebody who's such a constant professional to kind of give you a nod like that, especially when you're gunning to open. It's a scary time for any restaurateur. It gave me a lot of confidence. And he had that way about him, for sure.
Henry and Scott, thanks for spending time with us and helping us remember Randy Perigary.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you very much.
Scott Ostrander is the co-owner and executive chef at Origami Asian Grill in East Sacramento, and Henry DeVere White is the co-owner of DeVere's Irish Pub in Midtown Sacramento. Before we leave today, we do have a programming note to pass along to all of you. I, along with two of my fellow journalists from the Sacramento Bee, will be moderating the Sacramento Press Club's debate between four of the Republican gubernatorial candidates. The debate will be held at the Guild Theater in Oak Park. Cap Radio will be airing the debate in its entirety Wednesday, tomorrow, during our normal Insight slot, followed by a half-hour special with analysis and commentary following the debate. So please join us for the special event, 9 a.m. Wednesday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.